Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for Banal of America
of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, and at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. And could that ever be more apt than the start we're off to here tonight? And I know a lot of people out there listening. Well, it's all going to be cleaned up anyway, so we don't want to belabor it. But the blame lies with Blog Talk, folks, not with me. It's not my Radio Shack phone this time. It's somehow Blog Talk went down at the ideal time when we start the show. So, yeah, hopefully that was the end of it, and we can get going here with the prolific Nick Redfern. Nick, how many books have you written at this point?
I think it's 41 or 42, something like that. So,
wow. All right. 41 or 42.
That is across like 22 years, so it's like two a year. If you look at it like that, it's not too hard, you know what I mean?
So, yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah. This is coming from the guy who's written zero books. So, yeah, it sounds like it's not hard at all. I have a theory, though. I think that you write these books while you're doing these shows. Like, I think you're gonna
yeah,
finish tonight's show and be like, oh, I got a whole chapter done. That was great. This was awesome.
Well, you know, joking aside, it is really the opposite. I like to sort of just do sort of 9 to 5 Monday to Friday and then switch off. You know, evenings, weekends, and because I think if I did kind of do this 24/7, I'd just be burned out. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
I'll be fried. So, yeah, I like to sort of keep 9 to 5, like I said, Monday to Friday, and then it's sort of total, you know, different life, you know, just to...
Yeah, exactly. That's when you step back from this stuff. I'm kind of in the same boat. Paranormal's my job now, so it's like...
Yeah.
It's like when you're not... That's why, for a while, like all last year, I wasn't doing shows, because it was so hard to do stuff, because it's like, oh, more paranormal, Jesus. But I missed doing the program. And I was going to say, you know, I feel bad. This is like kind of like ironic timing in a sense, because Nick's the guest here. Because I was going to say in my famous or infamous hyperbolically laced introductions here, but I got all thrown off because of those technical difficulties. But I was going to say, no one's asked me this, but if I had one regret about the show, because this is our final season and we're going to go do something else, who knows what. But this is the final season in the seasonal style of Banal of America. And if anybody ever asked me, they haven't, but what my one regret would be, I think I would have to say, at least on the list, would be not having Nick Redfern on enough. Because I should have made you one of the staples of the show alongside, like Greg and Stan Friedman and some of the other titans that come on over and over and over again. I used you more sparingly than I should have, and that was a mistake.
Right about that. I mean, you know, I'm usually on like once a year, twice a year. So, you know, that's not a. I never even gave that any thought. You know. Really.
Yeah. Well, you know, no, it's more on my end as a creator because you bring such good shit to the table that it's like I should have made better use of Nick. I'm an idiot. That's kind of my point because you know, with all those books and all these different. And what I like about you is you. And I'm sure I've said this before in the past. It's like you cover all these different areas. You know, you're not just a UFO guy. You're also doing the cryptids. And I also see that you've put out some stuff. I'm sure you've done it in the past, too, but I see some recent stuff that's, like, more conspiracy-oriented. You got a book coming up called The New World Order book?
Yeah, I mean, I like to sort of switch it around, providing it's stuff I'm interested in. I mean, you know, people ask me why I don't write books about ghosts. Well, it's simple. I'm not really interested in ghosts.
Exactly.
I'm not saying that I don't believe there's a phenomenon or, you know, no life after death. I think there is. But I'm just reading sort of haunted house stories and things like that. Just doesn't really do anything for me. So, you know, I like to write about the things which interest me, like cryptozoology, the UFO subject, some aspects of conspiracies, not so much political stuff, more,
yeah,
you know, sort of UFO conspiracy, that kind of thing. Those are sort of the main areas I like to sort of write about, because I think if you're kind of placed in a position of writing stuff you don't really want to write about and your heart's not really in it, there's no real point in doing it, you know what I mean? If you,
yeah,
do something that you do enjoy. And I think that applies to every aspect in life, you know, if you don't like the way your life is, change it. Or, you know, so that's what I try and do. I try and sort of, you know, go with the things that I'm interested in, because I think if you're not really into it, you know, the research can kind of be a drag. And like I said, you're just not, your heart, your mind isn't really into it. So
it makes it harder, too. It probably takes you even longer.
Well, it does. Yeah, it's like, oh, God, you know, I've got to do another 25 pages today or on a subject I have no interest in. So it's kind of like, well, don't do it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So as long as, you know, as long as I've got a passion for what I do, you know, and in terms of what I'm writing about and researching, you know, I'll keep doing it. If the day comes when I'm like, okay, I've done what I wanted to do and said what I wanted to say, then I'll stop. You know, I don't want to, what I don't want to do is end up like some, you know, like your favorite band when they get old and they just go out on tour and play the same old greatest hits and they're not as good as they were. It's like, well, why do that? You know, for me, I'd sort of prefer to get out of the subject when I felt I'd reached that point where I didn't want to do it anymore, or I felt I'd sort of said all that I needed to say. And, you know, I hope I'll know when that time is, you know what I mean? Rather
yeah, yeah.
than just ending up like some, you know, band 30 years from now or something, you know, like I said, just playing your greatest hits, but not playing them that well anymore.
Yeah, exactly. That's an interesting sort of point, though. Have you ever, like, gotten to the point where you think you might be there? Like, have you ever had sort of moments where you're like, I don't know what I'm going to, you know, maybe I've reached my limit here?
No, I wouldn't say that hasn't happened, but I think it's always important to be kind of mindful. And there have been times when, you know, that I haven't written many books because the subjects weren't there that I wanted to write about.
Right.
So, you know, although I guess I've been lucky in the sense by doing two a year, I've largely been able to maintain, you know, writing about subjects that do interest me, that hopefully interest the readers. But, I mean, between 1999, when my third book came out, I didn't write another book till 2003. There was like a four-year period in which I didn't write any books at all. That was purely and simply because I was like, well, you know, I'm trying to, if I want to write a book right now, it would be like forced. And so, again, there's no point forcing yourself to write something that you don't want to do. But I've sort of, you know, got into that mode where there are a lot of things that interest me, which I think will interest the readers. But, you know, sometimes they may be obscure things, and they don't sell that well. But, you know, that's not the motivation. You know, the main motivation is getting the information out and help people enjoy the books. I mean, some of my books have sold, one of them sold about 13 or 14,000 copies, which is, you know, which is pretty good for an obscure subject like UFOs.
Yeah.
Some of them at 4,000 or 5,000. I think two or three of my books are still below like 500 because they're like really obscure, weird subjects, you know. But, you know, to me, that's fine. If the people who do buy them enjoy them, well, that's cool. You know, I'm not looking as a book as a failure if it sells 500 copies, I'm looking at, you know, it's a good thing that there are 500 people who share my fascination for that particular topic. So.
Yeah. Have you ever considered writing a biography?
I actually did think about that a couple of times, and I would actually do that. You know, if there was somebody in ufology or cryptozoology who had a really sort of fascinating life and, you know, that I could sort of tell a really good story. I mean,
kind of did in a way with the Contactees book, I guess, right? Because that's kind of like, in a way, it's kind of like a series of smaller vignette-like
biographies. But, I mean, that's doable. Again, it comes down to, you know, finding one that hasn't been done. I wouldn't do this one because it would be such a complicated book to research. It would take years. But, I mean, I think the perfect one would be like a biography of John Keel. You know, that would be a really good one.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, from day one till the day he died. But, again, I think that would take up so much time doing the research and, you know, it would be a major project. Not that there's anything obviously wrong with a major project, but I mean, I think, you know, it would be somebody like that if I was going to do that,
right,
or you know, a big figure in cryptozoology. But again, you know, it's got to be, you know, an adventurous, fun life that you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's not going to read well if it's just some guy who sits at home, you know, and does nothing. I mean,
yeah.
That's not going to read well.
Exactly. Now, can you? I feel like you're probably the best person to ask about this. It came up when I was talking to Marie a couple of weeks ago. I think it was Marie. What the hell's going on with this Rendlesham thing? You know, I know it's been sort of like controversial over the last. There's like these infights and everything over the last few years, but it seems like it's exploding even more lately, and I don't want to get into, like, telling tales out of school, but he's already posted the shit on Facebook. Like, Peter Robbins has had some kind of schism with Larry Warren, and I don't know what that's all about. And Peter posted, like, a screed on his Facebook today, and I only read a part of it, so I don't know too much about it. But I figure, I assume, you know, you might have something to know about, or at the very least, what the hell's going on with all this infighting in the Rendlesham thing.
Well, I've got to be honest, I haven't followed the infighting, but I mean, I do know Larry and Peter. I met them both the first time about 20 years ago back in England when they were touring around with the book, you know. And, you know, I...
If you don't know about it, that's fine.
I did see that there was a big controversy about it, but I just haven't followed it that deeply. I honestly don't know all the... The who said about this or whatever. I haven't followed it deeply. But, I mean, what I will say, like I said, I first met him about 20 years ago in England when they were touring around on Left at Eastgate because it had just come out. And, you know, over the years, I've hung out with Larry and Peter and, you know, had no issues or no problems. The only thing I do know, pretty much, is that, you know, there's been this debate about the data in the book. But, you know, I'm honestly not avoiding the situation. I actually haven't followed what the claims and the accusations are.
All right, sorry. Because I haven't either. You and I are a lot alike where it's like,
the main reason why I haven't is chiefly because, you know, if I'm working in the day and whatever, writing books and magazine articles, to be honest, when I finish for the day, I don't surf around the net for UFO stuff, a life away. So, but I mean, what I would say, you know, ufology has always been sort of in a state of flux in terms of people in the subject. And of course, when, you know, you have different people who are involved in the same cases from different perspectives, then that can cause complications too. And I think from some of the things I've seen, maybe that's what people were talking about in Rendlesham, about, you know, different people having different version of events. But as I say, I'm not aware of the specifics. But, you know, I mean, you can go back to the days of, like, George Adamski. And again, it's sort of that he said, she said situation, you know, where you have people who are major followers of Adamski and there are people who just, you know, blow him off and there are other people somewhere in between. And I think when you're dealing with controversial cases, and this doesn't necessarily just relate to UFOs or even the paranormal, you know, when controversy surfaces, there's always going to be, you know, different points of view, etc. But now, I mean, I guess after you've sort of, you know, brought all this up, I'm going to have to catch up and read.
Yeah,
up on
no,
it.
I didn't mean to curse you with that. With
no,
that,
I don't mind. It's just, you know, I remember a couple of years ago when me and Greg were on, and you asked me a couple of specific questions. You remember about certain
you
know, like breaking UFO cases, and you said, "What do you think about this?" And I was like, "What is it?" You know?
Yeah, exactly.
You remember that?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I'll wrangle Peter and get him on the show to get all this out. But I don't know. Something happens. That's all I know. And I think you and I are a lot alike too, where it's like,
oh yeah. I mean, I know there's been a fallout, but I haven't actually read it. You know, anything in depth to know exactly what the fallout is.
Right. I'm in the same boat. Yeah. So, all right. Yeah. And I think you and I are a lot alike in the sense where it's like, unless it's something really crazy like that MUFON scandal earlier a couple months ago, it's like I generally try not to get mixed up in these.
Oh, yeah, that was a whole
fights.
Story in itself, you know.
Yeah. So talk about, you've already talked in depth, like everywhere, about the new Roswell book, but I guess we had you on, I don't know if we talked about it before, but I'm sure we have sort of talked about your research. So what, I guess, is this like a new reissuing of the research, and like I presume you found some new stuff?
Well, yeah, the first book I did on Roswell was called Body Snatchers in the Desert. That came out in 2005, so 12
years
ago.
Wow,
yeah, that
seems just, like yesterday.
That's an oldie now.
Yeah.
And basically, for people who don't know, it was a study or an account of all the various stories that I got from a bunch of old-timers in the military, etc., who said that, yes, something did come down at Roswell. It wasn't a weather balloon or a mogul balloon, and the bodies weren't crash test dummies. But they claimed that it wasn't extraterrestrial either. They claimed that it was essentially like a series of dark and dubious human experiments using people in high altitude flights, exposure to cosmic rays, and the effects of high altitude, things like this, and that some of these experiments reportedly went wrong, and the guinea pig people on board were killed, and some of these events where these incidents occurred in New Mexico, and they crashed, and in some cases, as with the Roswell case, that public, like the rancher Matt Brazel, got to the crash site before the military, saw this strange wreckage, the bodies which had been laying out in the sun for a couple of days, etc. And they claimed that the legends of the crashed UFO story were basically based around these controversial human experiments. Now, of course, when the book came out, you know, I was like the worst thing since Saddam Hussein, you know what I mean?
It was, right.
I mean, I'd get up every morning and click on UFO updates, and there'd be another one. How dare Nick Redfern say this? But, I mean, you know, I got thick skin. I don't care about that, you know. Somebody wants to argue with me, I'll argue back, you know. They want to take a swing, they'll end up on the floor.
There you go.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's all fine with me, you know. I grew up in the English pubs, and, you know, I can easily protect myself and take care of myself.
There you go.
But, yeah, I mean, it was a situation where, people... Just it wasn't so much that people didn't believe it. It was clear from the words of a lot of people, they didn't want to believe that was the answer. And in one sense, I get that. But also, I take the view that if you have already got a belief system for any case in place, and, yeah, you might be right, but when you want it to be this or you want it to be that, that's like kind of, for me at least, that's crossing the line from being open-minded to, you know, to have... just having a belief system.
Right.
And the new book, which is called The Roswell UFO Conspiracy, which has just come out about 3 weeks ago, it's basically a follow-on from Body Snatchers in the Desert. And the reason why it's taken me 12 years to put out a sequel is simply because that's how long it's taken to get enough new material to warrant writing a book as a follow-up. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like... a rehash of the original book or a rewrite. It's all new material.
Ah, okay.
But there's no way I could have written it, say, 3 or 4 years ago, because the book would have been, you know, 100 pages or whatever, and there's nobody wants to read a 100-page book, you know. So, so really, it was only this year that I was able to be in a position to finally say, well, there's enough material, enough words here to warrant a book. And one of the things that I pointed out in the book, which wasn't really mentioned in the first book because it didn't really occur to me until the book came out, people were constantly saying when the first book came out, oh, this is Nick Redfern's theory or Nick Redfern's idea. What I've pointed out in the new book is that despite the fact that people said that, and in some cases still do, the story of this idea that the experiments involved handicapped people and Japanese personnel and things like this in these, and even prisoners in these sort of experiments, sort of against their will. The story itself, although I wrote a book about it now too, a number of other sources have also published the same story from completely different sources. For example, back in 1997, Popular Mechanics magazine, which is a, you know, well-respected magazine, they put out a story in the summer of 97, which was actually the 50th anniversary of Roswell.
Yeah.
They put out an article stating that they'd been told of a forthcoming release of documents which would tell of these human experiments that had to be sort of hidden at all costs. Leonard Stringfield, who died in 94, he published the same story in 1991 about Japanese people reportedly brought over or who were from the end of the Second World War, Japanese scientists brought over involved in these experiments. And Keith Basterfield, a well-respected Australian researcher, actually before Body Snatchers came out, he was given an almost identical story to the one that I told in Body Snatchers. And it was only after Body Snatchers came out and Keith read the book that he was like, wow, you know, this is actually the same story I was told, you know, however long before. So in other words, when people ask me if I think I'm on the right track, I think I probably am, but obviously I can't prove it. You know, I'm honest enough to admit I cannot prove the theory.
Yeah.
But when you have multiple people all around the world getting the same story but from different sources and sometimes in very obscure ways, that it doesn't mean the story's true or can be proved to be true, but what it does show is that it's actually a story that's been out there a long time, but a lot of researchers haven't done much with it.
Mm.
And in some cases, they've actually actively buried it because they don't want the story out. They don't want, you know, ufology's sacred cow to be affected in any way, or as I call it, St. Roswell.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, and this is one of the problems I have with Roswell as a case and some of the people in it, is that when you elevate one case to the most important UFO event of all time, if it crashes, then people are going to become very disillusioned and maybe even walk away from ufology. Now, if you just had, let's say, a famous abduction case and it turned out to be a hoax, or a famous photograph and that turned out to be faked, ufology wouldn't come crashing down. But I actually do think that if Roswell crashes as a UFO event, at least, there will be widespread disillusionment and, you know, a sense of why bother. And that's not because of it's just one case. But
right.
I think that will happen because ufology has sort of put all its eggs in one basket and hoped that Roswell is going to be the case. And ufology should not have done that. It should have been viewed as, yes, a very interesting case, but let's not put it on such a high pedestal that if it falls, you know, people are just going to be traumatized. And I think people will. And unfortunately, there's another angle, which is a very... I don't think it's cynical, because I get to see a lot of what's going on in the background.
Mm.
I see some conferences where the lecturers, you know, they just want to tell people what they think people want to hear, you know, because why? Because they get their nice fee at the conference.
And they buy their books and shit at the table.
Now, I mean, in fairness, I do that as well. But
yeah, yeah, no, I know.
I'm speaking at Roswell at the end of this month at the Roswell Festival. Now, if I was to write a book saying I've got brand new stuff on the alien angle, I'm sure I would sell a shitload more than I would saying I think it's a military experiment.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But I'm not going to do that. I have to go whereas I see the evidence. But I know of some very well-known people in ufology who will cynically go to a conference and just say what they think the audience wants to hear. Oh, and buy my books, you know.
Right,
and there's nothing wrong when your full-time job is writing books. There's nothing wrong with saying, oh, buy my books. But, you know, be honest with yourself and be honest with your audience. I mean, a classic example is the disclosure movement.
Oh, God.
You know, so many people hang on the idea that disclosure's coming. And I've been to so many conferences where speakers on disclosure have said, you know, it's coming next month, or it's coming in 6 months, or I have insider sources have said it's coming in 8 weeks' time, you know, or it's coming at 2:30 next Friday afternoon or whatever, you know.
Right.
But the problem is it doesn't come and it hasn't come. My view is that it won't come. But, you know, I kind of have this loathing of people who get the audience all fired up and say, I've got an insider and it's coming next week. Oh, and by the way, you know, it's in this book. That's not the way to do it, you know. The way to do it is yes, tell the audience what's going on, what you've found, but if it doesn't tie in with what the audience wants to hear, well, don't shy away from that. Just be honest and say, hey, guys, you know, we may actually have been deceived into what we think happened. You may not like it. You may not like me for telling it, but that's how it is, you know.
Right, right, exactly, yeah. I don't begrudge anyone selling books or anything like that, but it's like,
no.
If your whole shtick is like to be the person who, you know, reinforces these people's beliefs and shit, and you know, then that's where you're getting into, like, you're not an athlete, you're a sports entertainer territory, you know. You're kind of a wrestler or something. You're not really a ufologist.
Yeah, so, you know, in that sense, it's a fine line, you know, between you know, how you handle cases. And I mean, I've had some people say that because I wrote this Roswell book, or the two of them, then I'm a UFO debunker, you know.
That again
sort of demonstrates the power that Roswell has over people as a case. You know, I'm not a UFO debunker. I mean, I got in the subject because my dad worked on radar in the British military, and he was involved in several UFO cases where things were tracked that were clearly, you know, nothing we were flying back then. But so many people cannot separate Roswell, the case, from ufology, the subject. And I've had this so many times that they're like, oh, you don't think aliens crashed at Roswell? Well, why are you a UFO debunker, or you don't believe in aliens? I say, well, I'm not saying I don't believe in aliens. I'm just saying I'm not sure that aliens crashed at Roswell. That's two very different things, you know. But again, it just demonstrates the sheer, almost like a hypnotic power that Roswell has over people.
Right.
Now, you know, and the other thing, you know, which I'm perfectly fine about admitting, if people say to me, is there a chance that I've been lied to and fed disinformation? Well, yeah, there is. You know, there's no point me saying, oh, no, there's no way I could have been deceived, because that's just ego-driven crap, you know
right,
what I mean?
Right, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. An honest researcher has to consider that.
Yeah, you have to. And, you know, but the one thing more than anything else that makes me take the view it isn't disinformation is that if somebody on the inside is going to create a cover story, why make it so controversial about using human test subjects? Why make it so controversial where arguably people might dig into it even more than a UFO crash story?
Right, right. Yeah, that's the kind of story that you'd think the Washington Post would be looking into, because it's not
now,
UFOs.
In other words, it's like disinformation programs are usually created to create a minimum of fuss, not a maximum amount of fuss. You know, that's kind of like with the Air Force's explanation about the crash test dummies, you know, that the Roswell bodies were supposedly crash test dummies used in parachute experiments. Well, that was non-inflammatory, it wasn't controversial, and it just got a quarter of a page in this newspaper or that paper. And on top of that, ufology just kind of dismissed it and went on its way. But the Air Force now had an explanation for the bodies, which they still stick to this day. So, in other words, with those scenarios already in place, the crash test dummies and, you know, the Air Force says that the wreckage was from a Mogul balloon, why confuse things and risk it blowing up by creating another cover story,
yeah,
you know, the one I'm talking about? So that's why I don't think it's a cover story. But, you know, I'll be brutally honest, that I cannot be sure. You know, there could be people in some dark room, you know, right at this minute listening to this show, sort of rubbing their hands together, thinking, oh, you know, if another 10 just believe what Nick's wrote in his book, you know, and then another 10, another 10, finally we'll put Roswell to rest. That could be going on. You know, like I said, people may not like what I say all the time, but I am honest about whether what we know versus what we think versus what we want versus what we believe, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we talked about this in the past on the show, but Roswell is lurching closer and closer to Tunguska territory, you know, with every year. So.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would sort of make another analogy more to like something like Jack the Ripper.
Yeah, yeah.
Because what you've got an old mystery that even just the words Roswell and Jack the Ripper, everybody has an image, you know. You think of Roswell, even to the general public know, outside of ufology, know that if you ask them, they'd say, oh, yeah, that was when the flying saucer crashed out.
Yeah. I said before about Stan, you know, it was like his influence is so tremendous. You could walk down the street in, like, South Africa and just show them the word Roswell, and they'd know it's a UFO.
Yeah.
They would say UFO. It's like, holy shit,
yeah,
man. That's quite
the
influence.
It's kind of like with Jack the Ripper, you know, everybody knows, oh, it was this killer in London, you know, back when, and all these, you know, and there's different theories for Roswell in the same way there's different theories for Jack the Ripper, and but everybody's dead pretty much. Well, certainly everybody's dead in relation to the Jack the Ripper case, but
right,
nearly everybody's gone who was involved in Roswell. So in other words, we're in that territory where we've got a lot of data, a lot of witness testimony to look back on, newspaper reports, theories, but getting the evidence, the actual proof, we're still at that brick wall stage. You know, it's like whether it's me or Stan or Kevin Randall or Don Schmidt or any of the other Roswell researchers, we've all got our witnesses, our testimony, et cetera, but each and every one of us has got one thing in common. There's a brick wall stopping us getting the 100% piece of proof that we need to actually demonstrate what really happened.
Right.
And again, to be brutally honest, I just don't see how we get past that solid wall, that brick wall. I mean, the only ways I could think of is that disclosure happens, but I just don't think disclosure is going to happen. Now, the other two possibilities is that something like a document or a batch of documents surfaces by accident. You know, mistakes sometimes do happen with things like freedom of information.
Yeah.
And it would only need, you know, one page gets mistakenly released, or there's an obscure mention in a 200-page file that got overlooked and it mentions the case. Then the doors would blow wide open. And the other way would be, you know, if there was some kind of like a ufological Edward Snowden, that kind of thing, like an unforeseen person on the inside walks out one day with the entire stash of Roswell files or a substantial number.
Right. I have to think that they're gone. Like, I have to think that you actually, if you had like mutant X-Men powers, you could just go and get them, you know, because you're invisible or whatever. Like, I don't even know if anyone can find them. They're like 70 years old. I mean, where the fuck? I don't even know. I don't, you know, I have a feeling they probably hid them away. And a part of me thinks that, like, the information, regardless of sort of like paper files, but just like the information, it's been like three generations. I feel like it's been handed down more by word of mouth than that. I don't think they wrote anything down, like, when all this shit went down, relatively speaking.
Well, that's a good point, actually. I'll tell you, for one of the things a lot of people forget, you know, particularly in the age we live in now, you know, everything's sort of preserved, you know, whether it's on your own laptop, you know, on your phone, on a thumb drive, on whatever, you know.
Right.
It's all preserved, and that's why hacking and things like that, it's so easy to do, relatively, you know, because people, everything's online. People often forget that back in the time of Roswell, 1947, everything was paper and typewriters. That's all it was. And so, in other words, it would be, you know, people say, well, how is it possible that they could hide all these files? Well, it's simple. If there were thousands of pages put together on whatever happened at Roswell, you know, the plans for the flight, why the craft, even if it was a human experiment or aliens, why it crashed, autopsies of the bodies, whether humans or aliens, there would have been thousands and thousands of pages. But if you think about it, if it was all, you know, 1940s, 50s era, crumbling brown paper now, then it would be easy just to keep that stored, say 50 feet underground, in a fortified bunker, guarded 24/7, and it's just, and it's all just piled up in, say, 15 filing cabinets. Then that would almost be impossible to get, because there's no way to access the material. It isn't online, you know, and it isn't hidden away in some, you know, in some data bank that is impossible to penetrate. It's just sitting in a filing cabinet. That could be the explanation as to why we cannot find it, because it is in sort of, you know, almost like the final stage of Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, where it's just shuffled away somewhere.
It's like buried deep, in the basement of, like, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base or some shit.
Yeah.
And not even probably there, but, like, Area 51. Like, you know, who the fuck knows what's in the basement of Area 51, but that might be a place they would put the files. But, like, you know, in a way, it's like, talk about, like, this. I don't necessarily know if I believe in MJ-12, but I kind of believe in the idea that maybe they all, you know, that there was sort of a small coterie of minds talking about this with the inside info. And it's like, I just don't think they would write a lot of this shit down, you know? It's like, where are they going to go? Okay, we have this super, super ultra, like, earth-shattering secret. Now, here, let me hand Janice, my secretary, the notes, and she's going to type them up so we can put them in a file. It's like, you don't trust Janice with this information. Like, you're not, it's like so secret, you're not going to even want anyone to know about it. So it's like, this isn't leave the room type shit, I think. Mm. That's my theory, at least.
Well, there's another, or should say a similar angle to that approach that you just mentioned. And that's the fact that, let's just say hypothetically, that aliens did crash at Roswell. Now, if the technology was so advanced that it was just, you know, inexplicable to us, it was just totally beyond us. You know, I'm not a big fan of the Corso book, where he claims that, you know, within a couple of years of finding the Roswell wreckage, that we were back engineering fiber optics and, you know, transistors and computers. You know, to me, I just
it's
can't believe that story.
Yeah.
But if you say, you do look at the idea that, let's say that what happened was a UFO crash, but the technology is so far ahead of us, there's a possibility that it really just has been stored away because we cannot do anything with it. We cannot understand the technology. All we know for sure is something's come down, we've got it, we don't understand it, we can't replicate it, and we know that there's life elsewhere because we've got these strange bodies which we've autopsied but which we haven't really learned much from. If you look at it like that, you can easily understand how it would be just stored away until a future time comes when our technology catches up and we can perhaps finally understand it. You know, it's kind of like if somebody time-traveled an iPhone back to the 1800s, you know, that not only would they not understand it, they wouldn't have the technology and the science to replicate it or use it. So in that sense, that could be like Roswell. It's like, well, guys, we've studied this for 50 years, 40 years. We haven't got a clue what's going on. We haven't got a clue about the technology. Let's just put it in a bunker, you know, until we catch up. And until then, it'll be locked away. No one will know about it. No one will find it. And maybe that's actually what has happened, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And if you went all that time back and gave them an iPod, it would only be, you'd only be able to fuck around with it for like a day, and then the battery would die.
Well, that's true, yeah.
Yeah, they'd be like, now
well,
I just have this weird plastic thing. I don't even know what it is.
Well, that's a perfect analogy with the technology not existing. The problem is with the iPhone, you couldn't charge it up because the technology wouldn't exist then to allow you, you know, to put your charger in the wall and charge it up.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? So in other words, that could be the position we're in. We cannot replicate the technology because we haven't reached the point of you know, like the people with the 1800s, they hadn't reached the point of having electrical sockets or whatever. We haven't reached the point, possibly, of being able to replicate the alien technology, if it was alien technology. And so, yeah, people may not want to hear that, that it's just all stored away and nobody's doing anything with it. But if you think about it in that scenario, it does make sense. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, it's necessary to, like, think outside the box on this thing with the Roswell, because it's, like, it's been so long that, you know, anything's really possible. I found what you said really interesting about how if Roswell crashed, pun intended, I guess, that it would be, like, I don't want to say a death blow, but it would be a blow for ufology. It's very, that is interesting. I was sort of wondering that as you said that. It was, like, I'm trying to imagine, like, the response of people. Like, I could see that in a lot of ways. I think that there would be, like, a sense of despair almost, like a serious sense of despair, where people would be like, and I don't think it would be like the new people who are in this. I think it would be like the people like me who, I don't think you're going to bail on Roswell if it, you wrote the book, so it's not like you're going to bail, but it's like people like me who are sort of grown more cynical over time about this thing and been like, what the fuck, are they ever going to solve this thing? And if it turned out the Roswell thing was bullshit, I could see, I'd stick around because I'm mentally, like, prepared for that possibility. But I could see other people being like, you know what, fuck it, I'm out. I know, I've put 20 years into this thing, and now you're telling me Roswell's bullshit? Like, forget it. I'm not even, you know, I think that there would be a profound sense of wasted time in a lot of people's
Well, there
you
would
mind.
Be. You're absolutely right on all those points, Tim. But the reason would be, like I said, not because of the case, but because it's been elevated to that
right.
huge level. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, when somebody's built up to be, I don't know, the world's greatest boxer, and then they get slammed down on the floor with the first punch. You know, people are shocked, not just because but mainly because of the build-up, you know, and it's kind of that with Roswell. And I think a lot of people, certainly, you know, in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, who've been at Roswell for years, there is this sense, I think, of it's got to be extraterrestrial because, what's the realization going to be if it turns out not to be extraterrestrial? And I've been doing this for decades and decades. I think certain people just don't want to face that possibility.
Yeah.
But, you know, you should face it and just go where the evidence is, not try and uphold a theory for anything, you know. But then again, the other problem is that I do that and then people accuse me of fence-sitting. So it's like, no, I'm not fence-sitting. I'm just open to what happened. I'm just looking for the answer. I'm not looking to uphold an answer.
Right,
people,
exactly, yeah.
You know, People want, very often, people want an answer, and they want it to be the answer they want. But, you know, life's not always like that. You know, I want to win the lottery on a Saturday night, but it don't happen. You know?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and it's sort of like to talk to that idea of the despair and everything and sort of bailing on the thing. It's like, I can say, folks, in a way, I'm kind of living proof in a different way because it was like, politics aside, I was sort of bullish on this Hillary Clinton disclosure thing, and it was like, in a way, it was kind of like what Nick's talking about here with the Roswell case, where it was like, the disclosure movement put all their fucking eggs into the Hillary Clinton basket. There was no possible way Donald Trump was going to get elected. There was no contingency plan. There was no plan B. There was no, you know, let's see what that's all about. It was completely ignored. And I know a lot of the mainstream media did too, but it's like, you're trying to fucking unlock the UFO secret here, man. Like, you gotta have a plan B. And when Donald Trump won, like, you could see the fucking air come out of this disclosure thing. Like, I threw in the towel at that point. I was like, you know what, fuck this. You know, fool me once, that's cool. Fool me a million times, I've had enough. And this was like, this is the biggest fool me job that I experienced in this field, just because it came like from a mainstream thing where it's like, okay, this lady's running for president. She says she's going to at least fucking try to do something. I'm on board, you know? And I, you know, it has nothing necessarily in that sense to do with the disclosure movement, but nobody fucking that's all they kept saying. That's all they kept pushing, that this was going to be the one. And it was like, ah, fuck this. What am I doing, you know?
Well, you're right. I mean, that is the problem that happens, you know, when people do get disillusioned. I mean, you know, I think if ufology sort of took the approach that, well, we've got a bunch of really interesting cases, let's just look at them and see where it goes. You know, it should be that simple. But you know, human beings, we're complex, you know. We have thoughts and emotions and feelings and things. And for that reason, which is a good thing, you know, but it demonstrates how, you know, a case can have a big emotional tie to it.
Right.
Particularly for when people have made it their lives. Which is one of the reasons why, like I said, you know, I like to switch off and have a completely normal life as well, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Which is important when you're dealing with something like this, because it is possible, you know, I mean, I see it a lot where people do get really obsessed and everything that goes on in their life is somehow connected to the phenomenon.
Oh, God, yeah.
I mean, I'm not criticizing people. I mean, it's more of a warning that, you know, to keep a balance between a regular life and, you know, don't fall into the position where, you know, which I've seen where people, you know, friends just drop off because they're just doing this 24/7, you know, peering through the curtains, worrying about the men in black coming.
You can't
live like that. But people, I know people who do. And, you know, it's not a healthy pathway to go down when you are so embedded in it, you know.
Right. That's when you're the idiot on Facebook who every time a bomb goes off, you're like, false flag. It's like, dude, no.
Well, I get a lot of those on my Facebook page, and I delete them off as soon as they appear. You know?
Yeah.
Because I'm just not interested in, you know, that all that crazy. I mean, it's like when there was the Manchester bombing. The first thing that was posted to my Facebook page was false flag. And I basically told him to fuck off, you know. If that's all you've got to say, you know, there's people injured, dead, and you're you know, 10 minutes into it, you're putting together a conspiracy theory that the government did. It's like, you know, get back under your rock.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Well, somebody posted a great comment the other day because I guess one of these Sandy Hook conspiracy theorists got sent to jail for harassing one of the families. And somebody in the comments posted, "Don't worry, she won't be going to jail. It's just an actor."
Yeah,
I'd like to see someone go up to her and be like, "So is it going to be an actor going to jail now, lady, or are you really fucking going to jail? Because I'm pretty sure she's going to jail."
And the problem is, of course, when you get so far into that pathway, it's impossible to tell people any different. I mean, I've had people tell me, or comment about me, I should say, you know, that I was like hired to tell this Roswell story, you know, and I'm being paid by the government or whatever.
Oh, God.
Well, you know, well, I mean, you know what this subject's like.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's not like, you know, nobody's going to be driving around the Beverly Hills driving a Ferrari because you're in ufology, you know what I mean?
Exactly, yeah. No, I'm imagining Nick as like an MI6 agent now. That's the cool part, since you're British. It's like, people won't accuse you of being CIA, they accuse you of being MI6, which is a lot cooler.
But, you know, it is one of these things where I get that, you know, but it's hard. I mean, I actually enjoy arguing with people on the net. It's, you know, it can be fun at times. But when you're dealing with someone who, instead of concluding the truth, which is I genuinely think there is a possibility that aliens did not crash at Roswell, instead of just accepting that, which is the truth, they create this elaborate thing that I've been somehow recruited and I'm doing this and I'm doing that, you know. And like I said, you know, you end up living in the Hollywood Hills because of the, you know, the intelligence community's paycheck you get every month. You know,
right, exactly.
It's like ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, people, and I always say to people, you know, well, come and see where I live. You know what I mean? I live in like a 400 square foot rented apartment. I drive a 14-year-old car, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm not complaining. I'm not complaining about that. You know, I chose the job that I enjoy doing. I'd much rather do that than be a stressed out businessman earning 200 grand and having an ulcer at 35 or something, you know what I mean?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
But in saying that, it's, you know, people, I've had that so many times where people have weaved scenarios to explain something I've said when the actual answer is just the easiest one, and which happens to be the, you know, the true one. But again, it's like, I don't know why that happens in ufology, but it does. There has to be another hidden or controversial or conspiracy filled reason why ABC happened.
Rather than
just the fact that ABC happened, because it's the easiest answer, you know, because that is the answer.
Right, right, yeah. It's like the guy whose wife's cheating on him, and he has these elaborate reasons why she couldn't possibly be cheating on him. It's like, folks, just wake up. This is what, you know, the UFOs are cheating on us. They're cheating on us.
Yeah, I mean, he just kind of like, you know, denies it all or whatever, you know. Who knows? But I mean, but again, that, a lot of that does come again in all works of life. I mean, all walks of life. I mean, it's kind of like with UFO groups. You know, there's these arguments. I want to be the assistant director. I want to be, you know, whatever. And
I think there's an opening in Pennsylvania.
And I think, you know, you probably see this in, not that I know anything about the subject, but I mean, I'm sure like in the golfing community, you know, golf.
Oh,
club.
Yeah, yeah.
Somebody wants to be the chairman. Somebody wants to be this.
Oh, you know, I bet it's like parent-teacher organizations. I bet you they're the worst.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why I don't really have much to do with organize. You know, I mean, I lecture for organized groups, but I don't get involved in, you know, the politics of groups, because it's a joke, you know, when it becomes about egos and why is that person allowed to do a 1,500-word article and I can only do a 1,000-word article, you
oh,
know?
Oh, God. It's that petty, Jesus, yeah.
Oh, no, I've actually seen that. I've seen that question asked of a group, of director of a group.
Get a grip, folks.
Yeah, and but, I mean, you know, it's, again, I don't want to make it sound like I'm targeting ufologists. This is human nature. You know, it's...
No, I mean, Lauren Coleman was on the show last week, and we were talking about how it's like the Bigfoot field seems like it's turning, it's sort of evolving into more, into kind of like a quasi-mutant version of ufology, in a sense, where it's like you have these different state groups of Bigfoot folks. It's like, that really wasn't around, like, from what I can recall, like, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. But now it's like, every state has, like, a Bigfoot group. It seems.
Yeah, I'd actually given that a thought before, but yeah, you're right. And I guess, you know, a lot of it is just down to times changing and how research is done. You know, a lot of research is now done online, you know, when it comes to UFOs, rather than going out and, you know, interviewing people and taking soil samples if there's been a landing. You don't really seem to see too much of that as much as you did in the, say, the 50s, 60s and 70s, certainly. But, you know, like I said, there's no doubt there's a genuine UFO phenomenon. Excuse me. But I'm inclined to sort of more go down the, like, the John Keel path, that it's sort of more of a paranormal, multidimensional thing rather than nuts and bolts.
Yeah.
Aliens visiting us, you know. And so.
Now, let's pivot to Bigfoot, because you've done a lot of research on the Bigfoot thing. What's your latest sort of thoughts on this thing? You're of the belief that this is like more of an interdimensional type creature, right?
Yeah. I mean, my latest thoughts are pretty much, you know, the thoughts I've had for the last sort of, you know, 20 years. I mean, when I was like 10 or 11, I guess when I first got into reading books on things like UFOs and the Bermuda Triangle and Bigfoot, I probably was like 11 or 12, that thereabouts. And kind of like most things when you're a little kid or a young kid, everything's kind of black and white, you know what I mean? And,
yeah.
And you don't sort of see always the bigger picture. But certainly as I got into my sort of late 20s, you know, I began to sort of veer away from the idea that we were dealing with extraterrestrials, which we could be, you know, but we're dealing with something definitively alien, but I think it's likely more, like I said, paranormal, multidimensional. I kind of think the same with Bigfoot.
Yeah.
You know, if these things are flesh and blood animals, and because they've been seen all across the United States. And because they're so massive, you know, 7 to 8 feet tall, they've got to be the luckiest animals on the planet never, ever, ever to have been caught, captured, shot, tagged, you know, etc.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's not happened even once. Yes, we've got film footage. Yes, we've got photographs. Yes, we've got witness testimony. But we don't have anything concrete. Now, in a country, I get it, you know, the United States is massive and there are gigantic areas of forest land. But, you know, I mean, the report, I live just outside Dallas, and there are reports of Bigfoot-type creatures like 40 minutes from where President Kennedy was shot. You know, and we can't catch one with all our technology, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Now, people say, well, most people never see a mountain lion in the wild or a grizzly bear. Well, that's true, they don't.
But some people have.
But some people have, and some people have, you know, these guys who like to put deer heads on the wall or grizzly bear heads on the wall, you know, that kind of thing. Which for me, I think, is just because they've got a little dick, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's like an entirely different psychological issue.
Yeah.
But anyway, from my perspective, you know, if you look at all the people who have hunted animals or have tagged animals or they've gone into zoos, et cetera, what you find is that it's always these cryptids like Bigfoot, the Yeti, lake monsters, Mothman, it's all these type of creatures which are always 100% elusive. And if we had in the United States, you know, colonies all across the country of Bigfoot, we should have at least just one. You know, I'm not asking for 20 or 30 specimens. One will do to prove the case. And when you add to that the reports of Bigfoot hunters who've seen, and eyewitnesses who aren't Bigfoot hunters, who've seen these creatures vanish in a flash of light or disappear, or they've had an effect on like audio recording equipment, flashlights, things like this. When you put those issues into the context of the elusive nature of Bigfoot, I think we are dealing with a real creature of some sort, but it's not just a North American equivalent of an African gorilla. It's something much stranger, and I think it is sort of a multidimensional creature. Now, whether that means it's flesh and blood or it's some sort of energy-based thing that manifests in the form of a creature, I don't know. But it exists, but I'm not convinced at all that it's just, you know, an ape. Because, like I said, you know, when we first started on this thread, if they are flesh and blood animals, the idea that thousands, and there's got to be, because they've been seen all around the country, you know, there's got to be at least in the low thousands, and they're 7 to 8 feet tall, never caught. No animal on the planet is that lucky. You know?
Right. And I'll give you credit here in a sense where it's like, I remember interviewing Jacques Vallée, and I said, you know, you ask these questions, you put forward these ideas that I never thought of before, and it changed my understanding and thought process of the UFO phenomenon. I can say the same to you with regards to the Bigfoot thing, because I've come back to this thing that you have pointed out before, where it's like they have Bigfoot sightings in England, and it's just there's no way that country could possibly sustain a Bigfoot population. Just not really possible. And it's like, and if I'm sure people will argue that. Okay, but then you move on to, what about the Bigfoot reports in fucking Hawaii? Like, you know, like that land sprung up from the ocean, man. Like, a Bigfoot did not swim out to Hawaii and start a colony. There's no, like, possible way that a Bigfoot could be in Hawaii. But there are Hawaiian Bigfoot reports, which makes you think that there has to be something beyond a flesh and blood creature. Now, maybe, you know, in some places there are flesh and blood Bigfoots, but I think that, you know, there's a healthy percentage of sightings are something else. Like, it could, like, an interdimensional Bigfoot or something else, you know?
Yeah, have you ever had Stan Gordon on the show about Bigfoot?
Yeah, I have. I was actually going to ask you about that, because I wanted to know what you thought about some of those cases where, like, the UFOs and the Bigfoot, especially that one that's like on the cover of his book. That's like the you know, the guy came out of the house, he saw a UFO, he nearly shit his pants. He looked over at the fence and he was like, and now there's two Bigfoot.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, Stan personally investigated that. I find it really hard to believe this guy made this shit up.
Oh, no, Stan didn't. I mean, you know.
No, not Stan, the guy, the witness, I mean.
Oh, yeah. But, yeah, I mean, Stan's done a bunch of, you know, research going back to the 60s, really, and into this. And certainly, you know, he chronicled in that Silent Invasion book all those 1970s reports. Now, I'm not saying it couldn't be a flesh and blood creature, but if it is, it's only temporarily in our reality, you know, and that's why I think there can be like a wave of Bigfoot sightings in a little town, and then everybody and his brother's looking for them, but no one can find them. It's because, you know, they're not there anymore, but they were there. And but it's interesting about the British reports. Again, a lot of people don't know about that aspect, but many of the British reports of Bigfoot-type creatures are made around ancient stone circles. Not Stonehenge. I don't know of one literally at Stonehenge. But, you know, throughout the UK, there are literally hundreds of stone circles. Some of them are just, you know, like 6-7 feet diameter. They're like really small ones. And, you know, Stonehenge is known the best because it's the biggest one.
Right.
But there are quite a few reports from, like, ancient burial mounds, stone circles, things like that. So, again, you know, if these were flesh and blood animals in the UK of a normal type but an unknown type, why would they be seen so often around magical locations rather than just at random, you know?
Right, right, exactly. And it's like, I've likened it in the past to, like, you can cut off a starfish's thing and it grows back. It's like the Bigfoot might have some kind of powers we don't even know about, we can't comprehend.
Look, whether or not Anton is indeed a midget or a dwarf.
No, he's a midget.
What's the difference?
Well, a dwarf is someone who has disproportionately short arms and legs.
Oh, I know the ones.
Yeah, it's caused by a hormone deficiency.
Yeah, bloody hormones. Yeah.
Mm. A midget is still a dwarf, but their arms and legs are in proportion.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
So, what's an elf?
Do you want to answer that?
An elf is a supernatural being. Sometimes they're invisible, they're like fairies.
They don't actually exist, do they? In real life.